Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world, on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Thank you very much for all of your guest suggestions and thoughts about the show that you've been emailing in. The email traffic has been a little slow compared with the deluge that I normally get recently, so please don't forget to email me. Go to the website, theunexplained.tv, www.theunexplained.tv, the website designed and maintained and honed and cherished by Adam from Creative Hotspot. There you can leave a message for me, or if you'd like to, make a donation to the show, which is absolutely vital to allow me to keep going and also to develop the show and keep it churning on, as inevitably it does. But I do have plans for the show, and they will come to fruition. Very, very busy couple of months, these, as I've been trying to get the radio show at Talk Radio in the UK going and rolling, but I think we're getting there now. Your thoughts on that, always welcome. Your guest suggestions, and of course, if you want to come on the show, it's on at 10 p.m. on Sunday nights in the United Kingdom at Talk Radio. But our concern here is the webcast, which I've been doing for so many years, and let me pledge here right now that whatever happens, this show continues, because this is where it all began. And this is where I have direct communication with you, the people who followed this show over all of these years. No shout-outs on this edition, but just believe me, if you've emailed me recently, I'm very grateful for all of the things that you've said. And as ever, the shows are a difficult balancing act, aren't they? Not only the guests that you get on, but the way that they're handled. Some people saying, oh, you need to press them harder, and some people saying, you let that person get off with something there. I think if you get criticism from both sides, it probably is working. Thank you for the support and for making the numbers for this show grow all the time. The website, don't forget, www.theunexplained.tv. Now, the radio show on Sunday nights has been developing over this last nearly 2 months now, and I did promise on a recent edition that I would bring you some of the highlights of the interviews. For those of you who haven't been able to hear the radio show, maybe you're in a part of the world where you can't get it, maybe it's on at a time in your part of the world where you can't hear it, or maybe you're in the UK and you have to get up early for work and you can't hear a late-night radio show. So, by permission of Talk Radio, I'm going to let you hear three of the guests that we've had on recently, starting with the very first guest, Robert Beauval, then a bit from Stanton Friedman, who at the age of, I think he's 81 now, is charging ahead with his UFO research, the father of modern ufology, Stanton Friedman, old friend of mine and this show, so we'll have a bit of him. And a major contribution from a man that you've been asking for in recent months, Robert Hastings, on the UFOs that for decades have allegedly been appearing near our sensitive military sites and shutting down the missiles for whatever reason that might be occurring. So Robert Hastings will be the final guest, and a big chunk of him from the radio show. So just remains for me to say right now, before we get into these clips of guests from the radio show, thank you for supporting me. More great guests to come here on the online show. I'm hoping to be talking quite soon to Brad Steiger. We've been trying to arrange this, Roger Sanders and I, in California, for a couple of months now. So Brad Steiger coming soon. Also during June on this show online, David Icke is booked on this show. So any questions that you might have for David Icke, go to the website, theunexplained.tv, email me a question for him, and we'll be recording with him in early June. David Icke, all being well, coming soon on this show. So, highlights of the radio show, and again, thanks to Talk Radio for letting me use these on here. Let's start with Robert Beauval, Egyptologist we've had on here before, some years ago now, talking first about the Sphinx.
Look, in a nutshell, Howard, there is no doubt in my mind that the Sphinx long predates the pharaonic period, and my astronomy shows that it was probably there, not as we see it today, but probably as a full lion, with a lion's head rather than a human head, at least since the 11th millennium B.C. It's a time marker. It's the reason it is a lion facing east is, I've shown in my books with Graham Hancock, as you mentioned earlier, that it is directed precisely to the rising of the constellation of Leo, when this constellation would rise due east in the 11th millennium. So to me, that's it. And I've had eternal quibbles with Egyptologists, but the astronomy is very precise. But I'd like to say something which is now being really developed in my latest book. You mentioned something about the human mind. earlier in your presentation. My belief now, because I'm very much into neuroscience and quantum mechanics these days, working on a book with Professor Chandra Vikramasinghe. Maybe I should very quickly mention who he is. In the 70s, Dr. Chandra, with Sir Fred Hoyle, developed the famous panspermia theory, the theory that suggested that life...
I've heard of that. We've just got to say that clearly, the panspermia theory.
That's correct. The panspermia theory is a theory that indicates that life did not originate on this planet, but came from outer space, and probably developed long, long before our solar system developed. As you may know, our universe exists for the last 13.5 billion years, whereas our solar system is only 4.5 billion years old. So life could be extremely old, much, much older than our solar system. And now, with the latest discoveries of exoplanets in the last 10 years, we know there is about at least 3,000 exoplanets, i.e. planets outside our solar system, some that appear to be very similar to our own planet Earth. So the odds of extrapolating this number, because these 3,000 planets have been found in a very, very small area of our galactic system, extrapolating this over our own Milky Way galaxy, we think there's about 1 billion planets simply around our own galactic system. And we're talking about 10 billion galaxies out there. So the odds of finding life outside is very, very, very high.
So why the change of direction for you?
Well, because I'm beginning to think, the book that I'm writing with Chandra Vikramasinghe is comparing ancient cosmology, mm-hmm. particularly the Egyptians, with modern cosmology.
We have to explain for those who are unfamiliar with the term, and I know it's been used on the telly a lot, but what is a cosmologist?
Well, a cosmologist is literally studying the cosmos, the universe. Mm. And what scientists have been doing over the last 300 years, starting from Copernicus to Newton to Einstein and to modern scientists today, is they've arrived at the same conclusion, strangely enough, that there must be an intelligent design to this. They refrain from using the word God, but you can use whatever term you want, but there must be an intelligent design. It's far, far too complex just to assume it's haphazard.
Well, of course, there are those who may say the whole thing is an illusion, but I don't know whether that plays with you at all as a thought.
Well, yeah, I know there's a lot of talk about realities and what is reality, but I don't want to get too much into this because we don't have time. But
all right, so you're working with cosmologist Chandra Vikramasinghe, who's a very respected person and, you know, is often on documentaries on digital television over here. So some people who are listening to this, I think, are going to know that name. But how does that tie into your core work, the Egyptology, and all of the work that you've done?
Well, we're beginning to think, because we're comparing the ancient cosmologies with the modern cosmologies, is that the ancient Egyptians, particularly the ancient Egyptians, but there are other cultures like the Indians with the Vedic texts and so forth, managed to retrieve knowledge from within themselves. As you were saying earlier, we're literally walking universes, each one of us. I mean, as I'm speaking to you right now, there is 100 billion neurons firing in your brain listening to me and operating a body which contains 100 trillion cells, each one of these cells being containing your full DNA.
So this is a mind-boggling idea. It almost reminds me, and I'm sorry if this sounds trivial, if you were in England a while back, there used to be an ad for Guinness beer, right? And they zoomed in on a glass of beer into a bubble. Right? And they looked at the makeup of the bubble and then zoomed out to the glass, the beer, the bubbles at the top, and then all the way out to the surrounding environment and ultimately all the way out into space. The idea being that the glass of this beer was just a representation of what was out there, but on a much smaller scale. And I think that's what you're saying about the cosmos and us.
Indeed. What I'm saying is that each one of us, each human being on this planet, is a walking universe. Literally, everything that is going on within us is the same, made of the same material, the same atoms, the same subatomic particles as the universe is made. Except that we have a brain that is firing at 100 billion neurons all the time, we're barely using a fraction of this. The rest is running literally this universe that is us. Your lungs, your blood, all the cells, 100 trillion cells are being operating as we're talking now.
Now, Robert, I have to say to you, because we're running out of time, and that's always the thing with radio, that what we've had to do tonight, just to introduce you to people listening to this show, The Unexplained, on Talk Radio, we've had to dance around a lot of the work that you've done, which is not entirely fair to you, and I want to get you back to talk in more detail about this stuff and also take calls from people, because we've had people trying to get through to you, and next time, hopefully, we'll be able to do that. I want to ask you one question at the end of this, and it ties into something that's been in the news in the last week, possibly two. Certainly, the BBC and Sky were reporting this. The thought that there may be another as yet undiscovered, unknown chamber within the Great Pyramid of Giza, the one that we all know. Number one, have you heard about that, and what do you make of it, if you have?
I think what's been in the news was, there's since the 1993, there's been a possibility of a chamber at the end of one of these shafts I was talking about in the Great Pyramid. So far, it hasn't been explored properly. So that's a huge possibility. There's also a possibility of a chamber under the Sphinx, which has been investigated since the 1970s. Again, hasn't been explored yet. But I think what you're talking about is the possibility of chambers in the Tutankhamun tomb, which has been quite in the news lately.
And those of us of a certain age, you know, we may well have seen the exhibition that came to the UK back in the 70s.
Indeed. Well, I don't know if we're the same age. I was a teenager in those days. Since you mentioned it, I was mentored by Sir Ivan Edwards at the time, who organized this this event in 1972, to be precise. Anyway, there's a strong possibility because they've detected the possibility of two chambers inside the tomb of Tutankhamun in Upper Egypt. They think that it might be the tomb of his mother, Nefertiti, the famous queen that was the queen of the heretic pharaoh Akhenaten.
Sorry for the silly question, and as I say, time is ticking down on us, but how could that, if that is there, and if it is Nefertiti, how could that have not been discovered until recently? How could that have hidden there in
because
plain sight?
Yes, very simply, because technology wasn't available at the time. They've managed to scan. It came as a coincidence. They were scanning the whole chamber with very high-definition scanners, and they could see through the paintings, because there's painting on these walls, and they noticed cracks that indicated the opening of the possibility of a door. Since then, they've investigated the radars, and this confirmed that there is a cavity. So it's very, very promising. Of course, the proof is in the pudding, but if it is the tomb of Nefertiti, then it's going to be the discovery of the century in terms of archaeology.
Not to be trivial about it, it's almost Tutankhamun too, isn't it? Tutankhamun too, in many ways. Robert Bavall, thank you very much indeed for that. It's only fair of me to give you the opportunity to tell us what your website is if people want to know more about you.
Well, if you want to know more about me, the website is Robert Bavall. www.robertbovall.co.uk.
And very quickly, what are you going to be working on next? You must have a plan.
Well, my next book is, I'm working on it now, which is with Professor Chandra Vikramasinghe. It's called Cosmic Womb, and it is a study on the comparison of ancient cosmologies with modern cosmologies and asking big questions like who we are, where life comes from, and all those huge questions that trouble.
The very first guest in the very first minutes of The Unexplained on radio recently, Robert Bavall, Egyptologist, investigator, direct from his home in the sunny south of Spain. And we'll have him back on here for a longer show soon. Now, Stanton Friedman, the man who is loved and revered around the world as, quotes, the father of modern ufology, the man who was the first to systematically investigate the events at Roswell in 1947. Stan and I have met many times on the radio. He came to London many years ago, and I put him on Capital Radio back then on the Chris Tarrant show for a very brief appearance on the news. Since then, we've done many longer shows, and it's always good to get him on. I think he's 81 years of age now, living in New Brunswick, Canada, and still as intelligent, funny and feisty as ever. This is Stan Friedman on the recent edition of The Unexplained. He appeared on Talking First about what it is like to give presentations to bunches of students and their professors, and the people who profess themselves in public to be anti all of this, who quietly behind the scenes actually are very, very interested and possibly very, very supportive.
Well, I've met quite a few, many dozens, I'd say. I've spoken at 700 colleges plus, and mostly it's the student activities people who bring me in to speak, but I do seminars and colloquia, you know, fancy terms for getting a bunch of the physics students together and stuff like that. And since I usually get warned by the students that Dr. Jones thinks you're full of baloney, so I put on a little dog and pony show. I do, it's a little sneaky, I'll ask, what's the numerical value of 1G? 9.8 meters per second squared, they all know that. I say, well, how about in units that we can understand? You know, miles per hour. And they look at me like I'm talking Swahili. Well, 1G is 21 miles per hour per second. So if you get a car accelerating at 1G at the end of 3 seconds, it's going 3 times 21, 63 miles an hour. It's a pretty hot car. And then I'll ask them, okay, what's the speed of light? 300,000 kilometers per second. And I say, okay, put that in useful units. We don't measure anything else like that. Well, it's, 670 million miles an hour. I said, but the real question is, how long does it take at 1G to get to the speed of light? It's a multiple-choice question. You don't need anything. I'll give you a choice. 1,000 years, 100 years, 10 years, 1 year. How many think it's 1,000? Bunch of hands go up. How many think it's 110, et cetera? The right answer is 1 year. But we have just demonstrated that these smart people don't know anything. That's dealing with the real world. It takes less than a year at 1G to get to the speed of light, for example. They don't think there's any way you could get the energy. Well, they're ignoring the fact that almost all the energy in our galaxy and all other galaxies is produced by nuclear fusion. That's what goes on in the sun and all other stars. Everything else is piddling by comparison to the fusion that's going on. Now, we didn't realize that until 1938, you know, but, okay. I worked on a study of fusion propulsion for deep space travel back in 1962.
Was that canceled?
Of course it was canceled. Everything gets canceled.
So, you know, we're coming to a very important point here, aren't we? That a lot of this stuff, somebody somewhere, by the looks of your career, and it, just only on the basis of your career, but I'm sure there are many other examples of this, a lot of this stuff, it appears then, if we extrapolate from this, and I'm not saying this is exactly how it is, kind of looks that way, though, a lot of this stuff gets canceled because somebody says, this has gone too far.
I would say so, and the good stuff is being done under total security is all I can suggest.
And there we're talking black ops budgets then, things which are budgeted for and you can't actually see officially what they are, yeah?
That's right. Well, let me give you a couple of examples of that. When I was working on nuclear airplanes, it wasn't a black project. The sign on the door said General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department. In 1958, a long time ago, we spent $100 million that year. We employed 3,500 people, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. And I saw the handwriting on the wall and got out a year before the project was canceled. But that $100 million was a lot of money in 1958. Mm-hmm. Some people might think it is now. The Washington Post carried an article 3 years ago. The total military intelligence budget in the United States that year was $52.6 billion.
In 1958?
No, and this was 3 years ago.
Sorry, it's related to that year.
Yeah,
so that's an awful lot of cash.
That's right, and that's all classified. You got the NSA, never says anything, you know, those guys. Mr. Snowden, you guys are familiar with him. That's the CIA, and it's the NRO, National Reconnaissance Office.
So not all of that money, I'm sure, is being used in counterterrorism, although I'm sure a lot of it is.
Oh, no.
So some of it will be being used to try and answer the questions or develop the technology that might have come from UFOs, space, aliens.
Well, or to develop, look, the stealth aircraft was built by Lockheed. It took them 10 years and $10 billion. Everything was based on, we're going to beat the Russians. We got to get there first. You could get money for almost anything back then. I mean, they did spend money for all kinds of things. On the other hand, you can look at the nuclear navy. We have submarines that can go around the world underwater without coming to the surface. That first happened in 1960. We have aircraft carriers, nuclear-powered, that can operate for 18 years without refueling. That's very impressive to me. It changes everything if you're a ship captain and you can go full speed ahead for years without having to go to a gas station.
Stan, that begs the question then, doesn't it? If so much money is being spent like this, does it not occur to you as being perhaps credible that these things that we call UFOs and we see in the sky and we say, what on earth is that disc-shaped silver thing, might actually be ours?
Well, it's occurred to a lot of people, and but it doesn't explain them, because if we were able to build things that look like that and act like that, high-speed, sharp turns, hovering, noiseless, no exhaust, no visible external engines, we would. Airplanes are part of the armament of every major country. And it's why some people say, oh, UFOs, Hitler's people developed those. If they did, they would have used them. Nobody ever accused Hitler of having pity on the people he was attacking.
As you know, there are people who are claiming that that technology, the Nazi bell and all of that stuff, is actually being used. Stuff is still in somebody's hands.
I've seen no evidence of that. Oh, there's no question that the Nazis and everybody else was talking about round aircraft that could move in any direction. It's terribly desirable.
But you think they were only talking about it?
That doesn't mean anybody succeeded.
You think they were only talking about it?
That's right. There was the Avro car built in the United States and Canada. It was round, supposedly highly maneuverable. It got a few feet off the ground, didn't go very far, wasn't very useful, and the program was canceled. The stealth aircraft, you know what's interesting? We had a little war after that, and we used it. You use your best equipment in a war. You know, there's a lot of people's lives on the line. So governments can keep secrets. It's easy. You have some rules, and you follow them. And, you know, it's like with Roswell. They got around that. They lied. I mean, that's the easiest way.
Stan Friedman there, and we'll have a longer show with him coming soon. Always an interesting guest. And if you have any questions saved up for Stan Friedman for a future edition of this show, please let me know and we will get him on. Finally, Robert Hastings, a man who's done a documentary, written books on the subject, given talks on the subject of the UFOs that have appeared over many, many decades, witnessed by credible people in the military and others, have appeared at these facilities and appeared to close them down, or at least shut down the missiles in ways that nobody's been able to understand. These things have happened in the United Kingdom, it's claimed. They've happened all over the United States and Russia, and other places as well, probably. So, let's begin by hearing a clip from Robert Hastings' recent documentary about these events in the United States.
Declassified U.S. government documents reveal that as early as December 1948, incursions by mysterious aerial objects, later referred to as UFOs, began to occur at American nuclear laboratories, bomb storage depots, weapons test areas, and, as time went on, intercontinental ballistic missile sites. Particularly dramatic are the incidents now being openly discussed by former U.S. Air Force ICBM launch officers who were stationed at various Strategic Air Command bases in the 1960s and 70s. According to these highly credible witnesses, on some occasions, as the UFOs briefly hovered over their launch facilities, the nuclear missiles inexplicably malfunctioned. The officers had been on alert in their underground launch control capsules when they received telephone calls from their security guards at ground level, saying that they were observing one or more unidentified, disc-shaped craft maneuvering in the sky.
Now, before you say this is all hooey, and I know some of you do think that, but I'm glad to have you there anyway, because we have to be healthily skeptical about this stuff. Let me tell you, and this is documented, at one stage, all nuclear bases in the United States were put on high alert. So worried were the military chiefs and the government about whatever was happening that appeared to be beyond their control. So that's why we're talking about this tonight. Robert Hastings in the United States, in Colorado, thank you very much for waiting through that, and thank you for coming on The Unexplained.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
How do I describe you, Robert? What are you?
I simply refer to myself as a researcher. In effect, I'm the messenger. I presented information contained in declassified documents as well as the testimony of the former military personnel that you've mentioned. The documents are available for anyone to scrutinize at my website, for example, ufohastings.com/documents. One may read what the FBI, the Air Force, the CIA were saying to themselves in secrecy decade after decade, while at the same time their public relations spokespersons were dismissing UFOs as swamp gas and weather balloons. The testimony of the witnesses that appear in my film, as well as extended interviews available at my website and another website, ufosandnukes.com, one may view and judge for themselves the caliber of the witnesses and the validity of the testimony they have. So again, all I'm doing is acting as a messenger and trying decade after decade to get this information out to the public.
And what is your field of expertise? Are you an engineer, scientist, journalist?
I primarily worked as an electron microscopist, a laboratory analyst for the semiconductor industry for many years. However, beginning in 1981, I also went out on the college lecture circuit after having interviewed military witnesses for 7 years. It was convincing to me, and I felt the public needed to know the facts as they were emerging. So in the course of my semiconductor career, again, as a laboratory analyst, I was permitted to get out and lecture on a regular basis and have spoken at over 500 schools, that is colleges and universities in the United States, as well as Oxford University in 2010. The passion, what I'm doing, my real work is to get this information out to the public.
And was there a single incident that hooked you into this?
My father was stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base in 1966-67. He was career Air Force. There were rumors circulating about unidentified flying objects maneuvering near the nuclear missile sites. That's pretty much all we heard at that time through the grapevine. In 1974, a man named Ray Fowler, who worked as a civilian Minuteman program contractor, that is the Minuteman missile program for Sylvania Corporation, actually wrote a book in which he said that UFOs had hovered over the ICBMs at Malmstrom and created technical problems. The missiles began malfunctioning. He knew much more than he said in 1974. What has slowly emerged and evolved with the testimony, for example, of Bob Salas, who was a former Air Force captain, a nuclear missile launch officer, is that when these disc-shaped objects hovered over the missiles at Malmstrom, and as I've discovered in my research at other nuclear missile bases, on some occasions the missiles suddenly shut down. Their guidance and control systems were thrown into a tizzy. The missiles were unlaunchable, and the hardware subsequently had to be replaced. This is dramatic testimony, obviously. It's something that I tried to present at the National Press Club in 2010. Bob Salas and I co-sponsored the UFOs and Nukes press conference. CNN streamed it live, which they don't often do with press conferences on any topic. And at that event, Bob Salas and six other Air Force veterans described these very important incidents, which again have occurred on a longstanding, widespread, and ongoing basis.
Well, a year ago for my podcast, which is also called The Unexplained at theunexplained.tv, I was able to track down Bob Salas, who I know you know very well. I did an interview with him, and on the interview, we'll play a little clip of it now. He talks about the phone calls that he was getting. He was in charge of overseeing the missiles at one site in the 60s. And the phone calls he was getting from staff members on the base.
You can tell he's very frightened by his voice.
And like you said, these are very, very responsible, very cool, very mature guys, and people like that don't scream.
Exactly. I never had anything like that before. This guy was completely frightened. He said he had all the guards out with their weapons drawn and looking out to the front gate, seeing this glowing red object hovering above the front gate of the facility. He wanted me to tell him what to do next.
Oh, boy. Well, since it was not something in his experience and not something in your experience, what on earth could you have said?
Exactly. I was flabbergasted at first. I It seemed like we were under some sort of attack on the facility. So I told him, make sure nothing enters the front gate. Use whatever force you have to keep anybody out. So he hung up at that point. I turned to go tell my commander about these phone calls. And as I was waking him, we got a lot of bells and whistles going off, klaxons and lights on the panel. The missiles went no-go, which means they were disabled. All 10.
Imagine the scene there. Mid-1960s, Robert Salas is the man who has to report to his bosses. People around that base, and we'll talk more about this in just a moment, reporting to him that something was hovering over that site where there were intercontinental ballistic missiles, and not only were they watching and looking, apparently, but they actually were able to disable those missiles and stop them from being ready to use. Can you imagine the security flap that there would have been with that? On that particular occasion, and this is just one of many. We're talking with Robert Hastings, who's been collating information about these like nobody else has, here at The Unexplained. Robert Hastings is here now, and Robert, we heard a clip there of Robert Salas, a man that you've spoken to. Maybe we should unpick the story of exactly where this base was, when it was. It was mid-60s, wasn't it? And what exactly happened on that particular occasion?
That was at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana, and there were actually two separate incidents 8 days apart, as it's turned out. My research has demonstrated the date involved for Bob's case was March 24, 1967. 8 days earlier, there was virtually an identical incident at another flight of missiles called Echo Flight, and one of the officers that was on alert when that occurred, Colonel Walter Fiegel, has spoken to me on audio tape. He appears at least in an audio interview in the film that we've been discussing, in which he said he received, just like Bob did, a call from one of the security guards. He was 60 feet underground in the Echo launch control capsule. He got a frantic call from a guard saying that he was looking at a, quote, large round object, end quote, hovering over one of the missile silos. We now know it's Echo 2.
Okay, we've got Robert Hastings in the United States. I think we may just... he's just come back. Sorry, we lost you for just a second. What, this thing was hovering over Silo 2, yeah?
Yes, and seconds later, all 10 missiles in that flight fell offline, and the same problem, it was later ascertained, was the same as at Bob's facility, Oscar Flight, where the guidance and control systems suddenly were incapacitated, meaning that the missiles would have been blind. They could have not have been launched. There was an override control simply because they could not have found their targets because the guidance systems were scrambled. Those had to be replaced. What they call the cans, and in effect, as Bob said, you know, if the President of the United States, God forbid, had ordered an attack on the Soviet Union when either of these incidents occurred, the missiles involved in those particular sites would have stayed in the ground. They would have not hit their targets in the Soviet Union. So quite clearly, this is national security related. The big lie that the U.S. government has told now for decade after decade is that there's no evidence that UFOs have impacted U.S. national security. However, when you listen to Bob's testimony and the testimony of the 150-plus military personnel that I've interviewed who are involved with nuclear weapons in one capacity or another, it's quite clear just the opposite was true, that since the 1940s onward, these mysterious aerial craft have visited nuclear weapons depots, test sites in the South Pacific and Nevada, storage areas of one kind or another, as well as the deployment sites, the missile sites, and the bomber bases. They've hovered over nuclear bomber flights, squadrons, I should say, at other Air Force bases. So this is across the board. Anything involving nuclear weapons has attracted the interest of whoever are flying these craft.
The one thing that indicated itself to me very clearly when I talked with Robert Salas, who I know you've done longer interviews with, and all of those other people, was that there were two levels of panic here. There was the panic of the people on the base, who'd never seen, quite understandably, anything like this, and the effect of it in disabling the missiles. You know, nobody knew what to do. But of course, there's the other level of panic that the government and the powers that be, Washington, in other words, discover that there is something bigger than them that is able to call the shots when it comes to America's defense. So you, it seems to me you've got two levels of panic and fear going on, the people on the ground and the government.
I think that's exactly right. Unfortunately, because of the extreme degree of secrecy surrounding these events, virtually all of the testimony from the witnesses, all of the documents that have been declassified reluctantly, these were involuntarily released through the Freedom of Information Act, but all of the available data is from a fairly low-level field reports, some preliminary intelligence analyses. But all of the documents, all of the testimony is kicked upward. It goes to higher and higher levels of command. Persons at the Pentagon and other groups within Washington who would have access to this data at some point, that information is never going to be made available.
Well, it just seemed to me, Robert, that there was a kind of cascade effect going on, really, that one level, you know, perhaps at the base, at the very top levels of this particular base, basically decided this is too hot for us, we've got to hand it up. And then beyond that, it's like a lot of large organizations, people were handing this hot potato further and further up the chain.
That's absolutely right. And my point is that the people who really were calling the shots, the people who were making the final determinations as to what this all means and how to respond to it, that information resists being made available to the public. It's just simply, I mean, I have testimony after testimony about this case, that this case or that case. And yet when I attempted in the 80s to get documents relating to them, I was just told blanket, you know, denial. No such documents exist. No such incidents occurred. So I began getting some publicity in the early 80s, and it was clear that my freedom of information requests were going to be denied on a uniform basis. So I stopped filing those decades ago.
Mm. And the people actually dealing with it on the ground, let's take the case, the two cases that Robert Salas was dealing with, the man who was having to relay information to his bosses, and he was being told what was going on by people actually on the ground. He was in a bunker himself. What did people think they were dealing with?
Bob told me that he had sort of a flash of intuition that based on the description he was getting of a saucer-shaped object hovering and, you know, terrifying the guards and so forth, he said he instantly had a thought that this is visitors from somewhere else and they're monitoring the nuclear standoff. Now, you know, whether or not, who knows what the genesis of that thought was, but he told me that almost instantaneously he had the thought, this is not the Russians, this is something else, this is something higher.
And of course, it would have been just as scary if the Russians had that kind of technology. If they had possession of something that could monitor and disable American missiles, then that's just as scary as beings from outer space, isn't it?
Of course. And the majority of the nuclear missile launch officers that I've interviewed over the years, their initial thoughts, unlike Bob, was somehow this was either a military exercise designed to test readiness, but then they all said uniformly that the U.S. government would not shut down, would not disable large numbers of nuclear missiles for any exercise under any circumstances, because that would degrade part of our defense capability. But the majority of those guys in the 60s and 70s, when all this was occurring to them, their thoughts were this was either a military exercise or perhaps the Russians somehow were attacking. However, over time, as they themselves learned more about the events and eventually talked to each other, and when I approached them and told them about the testimony of their counterparts, their colleagues, virtually all of them now believe that these are extraterrestrials who are engaged in not only monitoring our and the Russians' weapons, but even tampering with them from time to time, perhaps to make a point.
In the case of Robert Salas and the other people you've interviewed about these events, what were they told by their bosses? You know, in the minute or so we've got in this segment to close it out, what were they told after these things had happened? Presumably they were told to keep their mouth shut.
They were, and they were told this was either secret or top secret, and some of them were told this never happened. Some of them were told almost all of them were told never to discuss this, even among their colleagues, the people who were sitting right next to them in the launch capsules. And Some of them, like Bob Salas, were required to sign national security non-disclosure statements, which stipulated a $10,000 fine and 10 years in jail if information about the incident were leaked by the person who signed the document. So quite a level of intimidation was directed toward the witnesses.
Robert Hastings is our guest. He's in Colorado, United States, talking about some research that he's been involved in for decades, some stuff that he feels that you ought to know. He's produced a documentary about his research with interviews, 150 people he's spoken to. He has testimony, has even got documents about this, and a real phenomenon he says that he wants you to know about here at The Unexplained on Talk Radio. You know, Robert Hastings is here talking about things that really happened, according to serious, intelligent military professionals who are now going on the record to talk about how the operations of nuclear missile bases were actually interrupted, not once but many, many times over decades, by what appeared to be UFOs. I think that's pretty scary. What do you think? Robert Hastings, thank you very much for doing this. Let's talk about some of the other events here, because this was something that didn't only happen in the 1960s. There was a case in 75, I think it was, a whole decade after the Robert Salas case, two B-52 bomber bases in Maine, which is way north of Boston, and Michigan, targeted both in the October of 75. You've talked to witnesses about this, apparently.
In those cases, what were described in one instance as a cigar-shaped object, reddish orange in color, the length of four automobiles, which seemed to be enveloped in some sort of shimmering haze, was observed hovering within 300 yards of the nuclear weapons storage area. These were for nuclear bombs for the B-52 bombers at the base. A virtually identical incident occurred at Wirt Smith Air Force Base in Michigan within the same time frame. And again, these incidents are not isolated. It just so happened that there was enough local media attention, civilian sighting reports about these two instances, that it helped generate freedom of information requests, and there were documentation that was released successfully to corroborate these two events. What I find of greater interest is the incident at RAF Bentwaters 5 years later in 1980, which again involved what my witness, a man named Charlie Waters, who was an Air Force security policeman at the weapons storage area at RAF Bentwaters, which, despite what the Air Force will claim, held actually the largest collection of tactical nuclear bombs in Europe at the time.
Just before we get off these American cases in 75, though, I was captivated by one witness account. You've got a guy called Sergeant Steve Eichner. Described something in the air, the shape of a big football, as long as four cars. It hovered and then it zoomed off at massive speed.
Right, and I just briefly alluded to that. He actually signed an affidavit to that effect. There was not a description in the document, but when the witnesses began to be interviewed by persons such as researcher Barry Greenwood and myself, I've interviewed persons there, they said that the base was in an uproar, that another base in New Hampshire, actually heavy machine guns, 50 caliber machine guns, were requisitioned and were about to be flown to the base to be positioned next to the weapons storage area at Loring.
Now that's interesting, isn't it? In none of the cases that you document, unless I'm wrong, nobody fired on these things.
I can't say that unequivocally. I have reports from other bases in, for example, Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota, where allegedly security policemen fired at one of these objects. And the report that we've received is that moments later, a unexplained source of heat came from the object that was directed apparently onto their vehicle, their truck. And they actually had to evacuate the truck, dive out either door to get away from the heat that was directed toward the truck they were sitting in moments after one of them took a shot at the object that was hovering above them. So there are these reports as yet in that case not documented in terms of declassified corroboration, but these come again from the vetted witnesses, persons that I've interviewed who were in fact security personnel at these bases.
Bentwaters, RAF base east of England, Rendlesham Forest, as some people call it here, because that forest was adjacent to the base. This was nearly Christmas 1980. The most famous extraterrestrial claimed UFO claimed case that the United Kingdom has ever seen, and as you say, claims of a nuclear weapon stash in that area. This is still the Cold War, 1980. We're talking about the usual tensions that have been ongoing for decades between the Soviet Union and the UK-US, you know, everybody in that axis. What happened for those? I can't imagine anybody listening to this hasn't heard anything about this, but just for perhaps the listener who might have missed, what happened at RAF Bentwaters, do we think? What occurred on that night?
Well, I think most of your listeners will know there were a series of incidents over the week between Christmas and New Year's of 1980, and there were encounters in the woods. On the first night, two security policemen saw a triangular-shaped object landed. That's a very elaborate tale. Two nights later, Colonel Charles Hulk, Lieutenant Colonel at the time, who was the deputy base commander, was told there was another unexplained light in the woods. He took a small security team, went out to the woods, and saw very strange objects. In one case, a red object that seemed to be blinking and winking like an eye. Skeptics for 30 years have clung to the very frail theory that they were simply looking at a lighthouse through the woods. Charles Hulk, as early as 1973, has said repeatedly in interview after interview they were looking at both the lighthouse and this winking object at the same time. They were about 30 degrees apart. You know, the skeptics just can't let go of the lighthouse theory because they're simply unprepared or unwilling to accept the fact that something anomalous was occurring.
Well, Robert, from what I've read about this, the only logical explanation that you know, the media and others could come up with was the nearest source of light, and that was a lighthouse. But that lighthouse was not positioned in a place where it could have caused the effects that people saw. It just didn't have that kind of power. It wasn't that close.
Exactly. And you know, the skeptics have engaged in intellectual gymnastics for 30 years now, trying to explain all of this away. If one actually looked at the witness testimony, it's clear that the lighthouse and a meteor and a crashing satellite, none of these supposed solutions for the mystery have any credibility whatsoever. What I have focused on, not surprisingly, is the nuclear weapons aspect of this case. Colonel Hulk said that after they left the woods, he and his team, after observing this object in the woods that looked like a blinking eye, they also witnessed three objects that were essentially disc-shaped in the sky. One of them moved toward the RAF Bentwaters base and was seen to send down beams of light, laser-like beams of light, and simultaneously on one of the radios that he was holding, he was hearing security personnel at the weapons storage area extremely agitated because some of the beams of light were falling into the facility or quite near it. I subsequently interviewed the man, Charlie Waters, who I mentioned a moment ago, who was a security guard. He saw what he described as a sphere, a multicolored sphere. I asked him how large it appeared to his eye. He said if you held a cantaloupe at arm's length, it was that large, so several diameters the size of the full moon, and it was moving near the weapons storage area down into the woods. In my book and in my film, 98% of the witnesses that I've interviewed I identify by name. However, in this case, there was a high-level nuclear weapons security specialist with NATO, a retired colonel who I interviewed in 1994. I do not have permission to identify him. He told me, however, that within days of this incident, two of the tactical nuclear bombs in one of the bunkers was removed and was flown aboard a C-5A aircraft to the Air Force's nuclear weapons laboratory at Kirtland Air Force Base, Albuquerque, New Mexico, where analysis was done. And he said, what he told me was he's seen the manifest, he knows the number of weapons involved, the date of the transport, and its the destination of the bombs. He did, however, say he was not privy to the analysis that was conducted at the lab. He does not know if weapons were chosen were compromised in any fashion by these beams that were observed and reported, but he did confirm that much to me. So again, you know, if you get out of your armchair and stop, you know, beating to death the dead horse of a lighthouse in the woods or a crashing satellite or a meteor, and actually listen to the witness testimony, witness after witness, what you have is an entirely different picture that does involve anomalous aerial phenomena and some very national security related issues.
The man who was investigated talking to many, many witnesses, taking in a lot of testimony, looking at official documents, the many, many cases over the decades, over 40, 50 more years, of apparent UFOs disabling nuclear missiles, not only in the United States and the Soviet Union, as was, but also here in the United Kingdom. We were talking about the RAF Bentwaters stroke Rendlesham Forest case, Robert. I want to continue with that because you've talked to, I think, two people who were involved in doing the radar tracking at that site around those nights in 1980, yeah?
Around 2006 or 2007, as I was writing my book, UFOs and Nukes, which is available at my website, ufohastings.com. It's also available at Amazon. Scalpers sell it for over $100. Don't go there. In any case, as I was writing the book and interviewing all these military witnesses at Bentwaters, it occurred to me that I had not read anywhere any statements on the public record from either of the air traffic controllers who would have been at the RAF Bentwaters Tower that week. And so I identified those individuals, located them, interviewed them on audio tape in 2007, and subsequently, as one will see in my film, on videotape. The two controllers are named Ike Barker and Jim Carey.
And Robert, how easy was it to get them to talk?
Actually, both of them were quite candid. Each of them are now retired. They said, no one can do anything to me now. And both of them said they were willing to swear out affidavits and even take lie detector tests. But they did essentially corroborate the fact. Some of them had slightly different details in their memory as to what occurred exactly. But, for example, both of them corroborate that on their radar scope, which was set at a 120-mile diameter, I believe that's about 193 kilometers, they witnessed a target, an object, cross it in less than two sweeps or 8 seconds. So essentially it covered 193 kilometers in less than 8 seconds. Just both of them said, and you'll see on the videotape, they were just stunned. They had never imagine anything moving that fast. As they were collecting their wits, one of them, Mike Barker, looked out the window of the air traffic control tower, and at some distance over an adjacent water tower, he said he saw what was an orange sphere. It was around its equator, had what appeared to be portholes, light emerging from the portholes. He said these were not navigation lights or any kind of surface lights. It was clearly an object that was emitting light from these porthole-like shapes.
So sort of classic UFO sighting, really.
Exactly. And it hovered there briefly and then left the area at a very high rate of speed again. The other controller, Jim Carey, is most adamant about the fact that as it was leaving, it performed a 90-degree right-angle turn at this very high velocity. And at that point, he just lost it. He said, I have no idea what this is. It has to be from another world.
And if you're an air traffic controller at a place like that, where the stakes are very high because it's still the Cold War, what on earth do you do and think about that?
They said instantly they looked at each other and a third officer in the tower, who I'm not at liberty to identify, and they agreed among the three and then three of them that they would not say a word about this to anyone. They would report it. Ike Barker told me of a previous incident similar to that in Japan when he reported a UFO, and he said he was interrogated all hours of the night by very harsh interrogators, Air Force counterintelligence, who he just gave them very technical details, saying this thing did maneuvers that no aircraft on Earth could do, and he ended up being told, you misidentify what you saw. So Ike and the others said, we're not going to go through that. I'm not going to be subjecting myself to career-ending reports. And so they didn't talk about this until I hunted them up 30 years later and got them to go on the record.
Well, I'm glad you did, because, look, the fact of the matter is, if you hadn't spoken to these people, our lives have finality to them at some point. They would have taken those secrets to their graves, wouldn't they?
That's right. And the important thing to note is this occurred the night that Colonel Halt was in the woods. They were listening over the radio as Halt and his team was reporting strange lights in the woods. Mm-hmm. and they corroborate this was the very same night. So again, the skeptics can say that Halt was looking at a lighthouse through the trees. Meanwhile, back at the air traffic control tower, there were multiple objects in the sky that night, but at least one of them was in fact tracked on military radar at the base that very night. And it's quite clear that its characteristics, its speed, its maneuverability, and the visual they had on it, the appearance of the object hovering not far from them, this clearly was not a lighthouse. This was not any kind of aircraft that we or the Soviets or anyone else had.
And in the meantime, I heard some recordings. We played them on my former show 10 years ago here. Some recordings of the security traffic at the base there, the staff communications, and there were recordings of absolute panic. If those were the real recordings, you may have heard them too. People there simply were out of control because they'd never come across anything like this.
Everybody was stunned. Again, it's one of the best cases, and the fact that it involved nuclear weapons. I mean, I have said repeatedly, whoever were flying these craft were not picking mushrooms in the woods, even though they were sighted in the woods. They clearly had the objective of monitoring and even tampering with the nuclear weapons at the base. In my opinion, that's the most logical explanation for the activity there that week.
So as I stare into the London darkness tonight, and I look up at the sky, and apart from planes, there appears to be nothing in it. We are left with the question, who would want to do this? When I say who, I mean what kind of species and from where would want to do this? And what objective would they have? Those are two questions I guess that none of the people that you interviewed were able to answer.
I think that's right. There may be people at the Pentagon, there may be people in the Russian military who know for a fact what's going on. Roswell may indeed have been a recovered UFO, alien spacecraft. And if that's the case, then a small number of people in the U.S. government know for a fact what we're dealing with. I would make as a final point that because the Russians experienced these problems, we now have documents indicating the Russians had missiles activated temporarily preparing for launch in a missile base in Soviet Ukraine on October 4th, 1982. An American journalist named George Knapp, amazingly, and one might argue stupidly, smuggled some top secret documents out of Russia. They've been authenticated. We have military personnel from the Soviet Ministry of Defense corroborating their authenticity, and they confirm that the Russians were having the same problem the Americans were. And so the question becomes, since these were incidents that both superpowers were experiencing, we have to be dealing with an outside third party that is not playing favorites. They're interacting with both the Americans and the Russians during the most critical period in human history in terms of potential worldwide destruction through nuclear weapons. I think that's the key. Someone from somewhere else, who they are, how they get here, what their overall intentions are, is anyone's guess. But it's clear that this has gone on. The testimony comes from persons who were actually entrusted with the launching of nuclear missiles in both countries, and they're now saying UFOs shut down or temporarily activated their ICBMs. I think it's time for the journalists of the world to take notice. This is not some silly fireside ghost story. This is something real and dramatic and important to all of us.
Why is it not happening now?
The incidents that I'm describing are probably occurring even as I speak. You may recall in my film, the last incident I referred to occurred in 2010, many, many decades after the incidents that we've been discussing previously. There were actually 50 nuclear missiles that suddenly could not be interacted with the personnel at F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming. That made worldwide publicity. CNN, I have a clip, CNN's coverage of that incident. What I did immediately after learning of it was to contact my sources, who contacted their sources, and we actually have three different persons, nuclear missile technicians, maintenance technicians, saying that when these missiles were in effect, the base could not communicate with them, could not have launched them if war had been declared. These persons say that there were numerous reports from the field on the part of the missile maintenance teams returning to the base of observations of a huge cigar-shaped object maneuvering through the sky silently. It had no tail fins. It had no passenger gondola. It had no evidence of being a commercial or military blimp, but it was huge. They estimated it was the size of perhaps a World War I Zeppelin, and yet it was observed repeatedly by these missile maintenance teams precisely at the time that the base could not communicate with these 50 missiles. And more recently, I do not actively seek out current active duty military personnel because there are potential consequences for them and their military careers. But I do have several contacts of civilians who live in the nuclear missile fields, primarily the Malmstrom missile field up in Montana. These are persons who are ranchers and farmers who have missile silos on their property. They contact me when they see things near the silos, and I know there have been objects described as spheres or discs sighted by missile silos on their property within the last two or three years.
So Robert Hastings, as we wrap this up, and sadly we've only got a couple of minutes left here, and I could talk with you all night about this. You are such a good and breathtakingly interesting guest. This is ongoing. It's happening now. And, you know, it's a phenomenon. It's something that's been there for not 40 years, not 50 years, but more like 70 years.
That's absolutely correct. And I've said again, it's been my experience, having been on the American College lecture circuit now for 35 years, the scientific community is not going to address this. They claim to be interested in new phenomena, but when it comes down to being laughed at by their ridiculed by their colleagues or getting government grants, they're not going to endorse UFOs or even express any interest in them. So that hypocrisy needs to go away. And the journalistic community, again, for all their maintaining that they are the servants of the people and attempting to find out what's really going on in government, both in the U.S., the U.K., and in the former Soviet Union, now Russia, it's a fabrication. It's a farce. No one is seriously investigating any of this. Again, in 2010, I had seven nuclear missile launch officers say to the world, CNN streamed the damn thing live, that UFOs are shutting down our nuclear missiles. It was a big story for a week, and then it died. You know,
Robert,
world moved on.
That's called the news cycle. Thank you so much for giving me this time here at the Unexplained at Talk Radio. It was very good of you to give me so much of your time. It's only fair to me to give you the chance to plug your website. If people want to know more about you and your work, is there a one-stop shop?
UFOHastings.com, and if you're interested in the film, go to the documentary page. If you're interested in the book, go to the book page. If you're interested in just reviewing these many documents that have now been declassified, then go to the documents page.
Impressive investigator Robert Hastings, and a clip from my radio show, courtesy of Talk Radio. We'll have a regular edition of The Unexplained as the next edition. Some big name guests coming on here soon. It all depends on you, though. If you want to get in touch with me by email, send me a guest suggestion, any thoughts or ideas about the show. I'm always grateful to hear from you. The website is www.theunexplained.tv. www.theunexplained.tv, the website designed and created and maintained by Adam Cornwell from Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. That's the place to go. If you want to send me a guest suggestion, an email generally about how you use or listen to this show, and when you get in touch, please tell me who you are, where you are, and how you use the show. I love to hear your stories. It, for me, is building a family. Nice to hear who is listening and, you know, what their lives are like as they get involved in this show. Thank you very much if you have been on recently. Some shout-outs in the next edition. So until next we meet here on The Unexplained, my name is Howard Hughes. I'm in London. This has been The Unexplained. And please stay safe. Please stay calm. And above all, please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.